Welcome to Indie Movie Cast, the podcast for indie movie makers by indie movie makers. I'm Alex, and I'm here with
Jay.
And Dominic isn't with us for now. He might be with us later, but we have a special guest host, and his name is
Scotty.
Hey, Scotty. Thanks for joining
us. Scotty.
Yep.
This is the second time we're recording this. We had some technical difficulties. But we're going to try to rehash what we said a few minutes ago and give you a good show. But this is Indie Movie Cast, the show about indie movie making. Jay and I are part of Ultimatum Pictures. We make indie movies in Albuquerque. We make short and longer films. And Scotty here is from Albuquerque as well. He is part of the growing film community here. And he is also an indie filmmaker. He's a writer-director, and he has his own production company called Trifecta Plus.
Yep.
Right. He's done a lot of 48-hour film festivals. He did one a couple years ago that he actually won. It was for a movie called Sweetie, right, Scotty? Why don't you tell us about Sweetie a little bit?
Yeah, it was Sweetie. We did that back in 2007. And we won here in Albuquerque. It was a little kind of sci-fi, creepy thriller sort of thing. And ended up, won here in Albuquerque. So it went to, the big international competition, which was in San Jose that year. And we ended up taking third place there. Which meant that we got to go to the Cannes Film Festival with it.
So you guys went to Cannes.
Yeah.
So you had a movie that played in Cannes, which is one of the huge film festival, indie film festivals in the world. Between that and Sundance, right? Those are like mm-hmm. the two. Cannes is the snooty, hoity-toity French one, right?
Cannes is actually kind of like Las Vegas. It was weird.
Really?
It's actually really Hollywood there. It's not that indie.
Funny. Yeah. They don't really play. They don't just play indie movies there. Actually, they
no. Their big movies. Premiere was Indie 4. At that
yeah,
moment,
I was so. Just. I was thinking that.
Oh, did yeah. you see that? Did you see that at Cannes?
No, we decided we'd rather go to the bar. So.
that's a wise decision.
Yeah.
That's cool. So, but yeah, that's tremendous. So you had a movie. Play at Cannes, it won all kinds. So I'll link to it. It's a great little film. And we've been talking about the 48-hour film festivals and how it's such a cool thing to be able to make a movie in a weekend and show it and it gets seen and I'm sure it'd be really amazing to win. I wouldn't know.
Yeah, heaven was
next
stopped.
Year.
No.
Yeah.
Next year, but no, that's okay. No, that. Scotty, you're a big screenwriter. You've written a lot of scripts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some a lot of short scripts, and you wrote some full length scripts, haven't you?
But I've written about 13, I think, feature scripts.
Yeah, that's
most
amazing.
Most of which are not very good because I was, about 22 when I wrote six of them in like a year, which is not the way to write screenplays. Because
it's good
you don't
practice.
Really put a lot.
You just
it's good practice.
Bug.
Yeah, I had the bug and I had a lot of 22-year-old energy, but that's long gone at this
a
point.
A lot of bourbon.
Yeah, well, a lot of coffee.
I haven't written a full-length script yet. I intend to this year. I intend to actually in the next few weeks get a start on it. But I've approached writing kind of differently. I think a lot of people they write their first script and they get excited about it and they pass it around and they try to make it sometimes and they do make it sometimes. But that doesn't necessarily mean it was a good script in the first place. I mean, I want to take you got to take a lot of time on your script. You got to act like it's a real movie, and that's something I intend to do this year. But and so when you say that you wrote like six scripts in 1 year, those weren't things you put a lot of thought into. They were just writing to write.
Right. One of them actually is one of my favorite scripts, but it's also one I revisited later and kind of rewrote mm-hmm. from scratch. But the other ones, I was sort of just starting and I was all full of energy, but not full of a lot of, discipline, I guess. So they're kind of messes.
And JT, you've written a full length script before, right?
I've written two actually. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you were going to write a full length script now, would you take a different approach, you think, than when you wrote those back then?
I don't know. I think we all develop our own sense and style of writing, I think. But I guess, yeah, I think I would. I mean, as far as like the first script that I wrote like several years back, I mean, if I wanted to revisit that, I mean, it would be completely different, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
but I think that's what I'm talking about. I mean, as you write, as you get better at it, you would change things. So when you just write, when you show people your first draft, that's not a good thing, really. But
you can show people your first draft, but you gotta take that draft out there and say, hey, this is something. I mean, and what do you think? You gotta take it out there knowing it needs work.
Yeah, exactly. Show it to people,
and I think
that's when people like George Lucas write The Phantom Menace, and nobody, you know, everyone thinks that he's written gold and stuff, you know, and it turns out to not be. I mean, it goes with professional writers, it goes for amateur writers. You got to just take your time, do it right, and make sure it's a good movie. It's not gonna be a good movie, it's not a good script.
Think about like people who want to shoot movies and stuff, like indie movies, like people write a script and then they're so excited about it that they want to go shoot it now because they want whatever it is. They want that instant gratification of like making a movie, which is fine, which is, you know, like we all want to do that. But if you don't take time for your story, then, you know, it's, you know, where are you going with it? It's still going to be a bad movie. So I think you got to like step back, slow down, you know, like, yes, you want to shoot it, but, you know, it's going to need some work and you got to take time to put that effort into it.
Right. Well, to me, the key is, you know, write your first draft in 2 weeks. That's fine. But then really the real skill and the art comes in the revision process.
Yeah. That's
if you're not willing to rewrite and not willing to really, like, dig in and gut something and just break it down to its bare elements and start from scratch, then you really should be trying to do something else. Because you know, that's really the only way to make something of quality, particularly when you're talking about something in the 90 to 120 or whatever page range.
I know that Ernest Hemingway once said that the first draft of everything is shit.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. So, Scotty, you wrote a script that actually got looked at by Hollywood, that got passed around for a little while. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, your experience there, and where it led you?
Okay. Well, I went to graduate school at Boston University, went to their MFA screenwriting program, and ended up writing a couple screenplays with my professor. He basically brought me in to rewrite some of his old scripts. He just showed them to me and said, you know, what do you think? And I told him what I liked and what I didn't like. And he said, okay, you know, are you interested in taking a crack at it? And I figured, why not? So one of them kind of didn't go anywhere. It just was kind of an unworkable premise. But the other one was much more like, much more kind of solid genre kind of thriller. So that one we worked on, and it went almost immediately to a production company based out of Denmark that was, like a Danish. Yeah. Cause he's, my professor was Danish. So he had all these connections. With like the whole Lars von Trier school.
Cool.
Yeah.
How weird.
Yeah.
Okay, so Scotty, so you're saying you had a screenplay, it got passed around, it went to Denmark, it got passed around to some, and it finally got to somebody who liked it, somebody who thought that this is a good script that might be what he thought that you thought at the time that it may be able to get made, right?
Yeah. Because once this development exec, he was kind of in the process of leaving his company, so he just optioned it on his own. And we worked with him for about another 3 months or so, incorporating his notes, ended up with about 30 drafts. And then in March of last year, he ended up taking it out wide to about 20 production companies. And once it hit the boards, which means basically everybody in Hollywood heard about it, we had another 25 production companies contact us all within that day asking for a copy of the script. So
it got a buzz.
Yeah, it got a buzz, and then everybody rejected it, which happens. Yeah, I mean, we got a lot of notes like, oh, it's not commercial enough, it's too dark, it's not big enough, it's too indie.
What was it about in a nutshell?
It was kind of a home invasion thriller. It was there's a kind of an affluent couple with a young daughter, and the woman is being stalked by this creepy guy who convinces his friends, who are these kind of thugs, to break into their house sort of under the auspices of robbing it, but really because he just wanted to get close to this woman, and then everything kind of goes to shit from there. So
that sounds creepy.
But so, yeah, it's pretty creepy.
So anyway, so you just a regular indie guy wrote a script. It got passed around in Hollywood for a minute, and it kind of died. And I mean that may sound like a failure, but it's actually kind of cool to me. You know, it's like wow. I mean, at least you got considered. At least it got, you know, how many scripts
right.
you get that far. You know, it's kind of like a big like reality show. It's like who can pass all the rounds and
well, and then
get a movie made at some point.
They call it the bottled water tour of LA because what happens if, you know, what happened with the script is it got passed on by everybody, but just about everybody really loved the writing. So I was able to line up about 15 meetings with production companies of various sizes. So they send you on all these meetings, usually with low level execs who are about 22 years old. Kind of just starting, assistants to, you know, big producers, and every place they go, they give you a bottle of water and then you talk about yourself and talk about writing. And it's kind of like a job interview, except you leave and there's really no job at the end of it. And my first few of those, I was really nervous going in, and by about the 10th one, I was going and wearing, you know, t-shirt and jeans. After a while, it's kind of like, whatever. Which actually I think helped me because I think once I relaxed, I was a little more charming, perhaps.
Charming. So, yeah. Well, that goes in any job interview. Be yourself,
right.
You know. Don't try to say what you think they want you to say. Say what you really,
right.
you know, but.
Yeah, you still got to be cool and you can't be a total douchebag, but.
yeah.
You know, I definitely did relax a bit. And then I happened to have a meeting with this one producer, one production company. The meeting turned out to be with the president of production and not one of the, like, low-level people that I've been used to.
Ooh,
but we totally
shot.
Hit – yeah, he's kind of a big shot. He's kind of like the second in command at this company. But I totally hit it off with this guy and started talking about a movie that they had produced back in the 90s that they wanted to do a sequel for, but they didn't really, you know, they just kind of had this vague idea of doing a sequel and they hadn't really gone to any writers or anything, didn't have any money to develop it or anything.
Okay, so
like
this
that.
So you're getting into what you're writing now. So you got this opportunity to write this sequel to a movie that isn't the 90s. And we're not allowed, and this is something you do, so we're not allowed to say what this movie is. You know, but it is a well-known movie, a modest hit from back then with main actor with Hollywood actors. It was a theatrical movie that you've all probably seen. We'll just say that.
Yeah, and it's kind of a cult film now, I would say.
Yeah, and it's a decent movie. It's a strange movie, but
yeah,
but you know, like we'll call it High Fidelity 2. You know, we'll call it
okay.
But it's something that random, I would say. But
that's about right.
So you have an opportunity now to write a sequel to a movie, you know, and is this sequel? I mean, is this something that if this is something that they're gonna try to pitch after you write it, right?
Right. Basically, the deal is, and this is basically how I got the job. The deal is. Since the recession has hit Hollywood, all the studios have pretty much suspended development. They're not putting money down for scripts that aren't huge blockbusters like Transformers or something like that. So anything that's a little bit off kilter, just you're not going to get any traction with. And so this company who has a deal with the studio wanted to do the sequel, but they couldn't get the studio to release any money to develop the movie. Basically, so it was just kind of sitting there as a concept, and when I had this meeting with him, we were talking about it, I basically said I'll do it, and there you go. So
okay, so great. So you got an opportunity, so you're basically writing a script for them to pitch later of some movie that came out when you were a teenager, right? It's an older movie.
Yeah, it's probably about 20 when it came out, something like that.
Yeah, is this a movie that they want to put out in theaters or with the same cast, or is it something that for direct video, like American Psycho 2 or
I mean, it's hard to say. They want to go out in theaters with it. They're going to go to the original lead, but he would be the only returning character. The setting is completely different. It's kind of almost more of a spin-off in a separate story than it is a direct sequel.
So basically, if they don't want it, you can take that script, change a couple of character names around, and, you know, try to pitch it as a, you know, a different movie?
Yeah, in theory, I could. Because since I'm writing it on spec, which basically means they haven't bought it, they don't have the rights to it yet, it's my script. So, yeah, if they or the studio passes on it, I could, in theory, take it out. I'd have to change the characters and some elements, which are from the first movie. But the fact is, if we're not able to get it done as part of a franchise with this previous movie that was successful, there's really no way I'm going to be able to get it done just on my own without any connection to anything. So,
well, let me ask you this. If let's say your dreams come true, let's say that this movie gets greenlit, your script is, everyone loves it, it's got the original actor, it's going to be a big Hollywood movie. What could you expect as far as money? Like, what does a script sell for? Do you have any idea?
WGA minimum, I believe, is
a Writers 50, Guild.
Writers Guild minimum, which, since this production company is a Writers Guild signatory company, they'd have to pay me at least that, even though I'm not a member of the guild yet. I believe that's either $50,000 or $60,000. Now,
making a year.
Well, and the fact that this is going to be, at least in theory, a relatively high budget movie. It's actually not a very high budget movie, but it's in the tens of millions, I guess I would say. Wow. And since it's a sequel to something else, I should be able to cold call any agent in LA and say, come and negotiate for me. And since it's basically would be almost a done deal at that point, any agent, you know, in theory would come in and negotiate a deal for me, which should get me more than minimum, should get me well over minimum. As far as actual numbers, I have no idea what I'd be able to get.
So you're writing the script, you're basically not getting paid for it, and it might die. And if it dies, it's just your script and you just have it.
Right.
If it gets bought, it potentially is going to make you a lot of money, and you will have and you will in turn also get a writing agent and into the WGA in theory. I mean,
it's all in theory.
But still, this could be a huge opportunity for you. And the thing that's cool about it is you're writing a script that is going to be read, at least. You know, it's not like people are going to slam the door in your face. So you have a shoe in.
Right.
Right.
That's well, and I'm on the second draft actually with the production company, and I haven't heard back from them on my second draft yet, but. They were really happy with my first draft. They had some notes, wanted me to restructure a couple things and make some cuts, but they were really happy with it. So, you know, that's kind of like the first major hurdle to get past. So hopefully in the next month or so, they're going to go to the studio with it. That's the idea. And then who knows what the studio will say. I mean,
yeah, well, it's going to get passed around a lot. And it's a strange thing doing it the studio system. I mean, I'm kind of embracing the indie side these days. It's like, if I want to make a movie, I'm just going to write it and make it. But the studio system, it's a little strange. It's like you have to impress like you said, you have to impress your boss, or you got to impress number one, and then they got to pass it to number two. And then eventually they'll get to number eight, and that's the guy with the money, and he'll.
And you got to understand that every one of these people, their job is essentially to say no.
Right.
Like you need to really give them a reason to say yes to things. So it's tough. The fact that I'm as far along as I am in a really bad environment out there is encouraging. But,
yeah, it's pretty commendable, seriously. I mean, one could say, "Oh, you're wasting your time writing a script that you're not getting paid for," but I don't see it that way. I think if I was presented with your opportunity, I would jump all over it as well.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how.
Well, the fact is, if I didn't have this job, I'd be writing something right now that I wasn't getting paid for. You know,
right? So it's all in perspective. It's all how you look at it. Yeah. So. So anyways, that's a lesson for you guys. You write your script. If it's and just make sure it's good. That's my advice. Yeah. Read it and picture the movie in your head and critique your own movie. Is this a good movie or not? And if it is, then if it's a good script, it's a good movie, then it'll get noticed. And if it doesn't, then make it yourself the indie way. Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say and to me they're not mutually exclusive. Because I'm definitely on this, currently got this kind of Hollywood thing going. Who knows where it'll go. But all it's doing is really making me want to keep my indie filmmaking going because, as much as I enjoy, the script that I'm working on, I happen to be working on something that is, a sequel to a movie that I was a fan of and am a fan of. So I'm having a lot of fun writing it. And if I wasn't having fun writing it, I probably wouldn't have agreed to it, but at the same time, I'm also focused on, we just shot a short film out in California. We're going to be shooting another short film within the next month here. I'm writing another script that we're hoping to do a feature, that we're hoping to do for no money here completely independently. So they're not mutually exclusive. It's not like, one thing cancels out the other,
Yeah. Well, tell me this, Scotty, if the script gets sold and you're in the WGA and you're getting movie deals, are you still going to write indie scripts and make your own little shorts, or what do you think?
I don't know if I'll keep making shorts. I mean, I would like to, but I think you just get to a point where it's like, you don't have time to do it. I definitely want to keep making indie things. One of my models in terms of a career, even though I'm not necessarily a huge fan of his movies, but in terms of just how he's approached his career, is John Sayles. He does these little indie movies, kind of on his own with a stable of actors that, he works with over and over again. And when I say little indie movie, I mean, he's probably working in like $10 million budgets at this point. But he basically funds them by doing Hollywood rewrites, Soderbergh.
Does he like a script doctor?
He's like a script doctor. He's actually writing, last I heard, he's writing Jurassic Park 4.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Several other... Frank Darabont does that too, right?
Frank Darabont does that. Who's the other one I was just thinking of? Steven Soderbergh. I mean, he'll do Ocean's 11, turn around and do Bubble,
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason why you can't do that.
Yeah. So, I guess you could be both. I guess maybe you can make a superhero movie to pay your bills once you're, and then still do your indie stuff. But,
right.
Whatever. We're talking about our little fantasies here in the future, I guess, at this point. But speaking of fantasies, let's talk a little bit about The Proxy. If you're listening, you just found out we finished shooting it. So Jay, you're deep into editing right now.
So
aren't
deep,
you?
So deep. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything you want to say about editing? How's that going?
Editing's going well. It's taking me a little bit longer than I anticipated, but I think this movie it's more. Pacing and rhythm, and so I'm just kind of trying to develop a rhythm with it. Usually when I edit, one of my own movies or whatever, it's, more action-y based, so I could just, cut, 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 Whereas this, I'm trying to slow down the pace, but, keep it paced well. Yeah, it's more of a drama. But yeah, and plus, there's going to be some special effects at the end that I got to get to, so.
Okay, cool. Keep us posted on that. But cool. I think that kind of wraps up our first segment. Scotty, anything else you want to bring up about writing or we'll definitely link over to your Trifecta Plus and your movie Sweetie. And I'd like you to come back on the show and let us know how the script goes. I'd like to know even if it fails or if it succeeds. I think you have a pretty fascinating story there.
Cool. I mean, the only other thing I would add. Because we're talking about a lot, the Hollywood versus indie thing, is I do think it's important, and it's hard because, if you start getting in a position where you're getting offers to do things, if you're trying to break in, it kind of gets hard to say no to things. But I think it's important to keep in mind that writing, you should write what you enjoy, and don't start, don't start trying to chase the money, because at that point, you're actually, the work will suffer and then you're not going to get anywhere. Don't sit down and think, oh, The Hangover was, successful, so I'm going to write something just like that. I mean, write what you want to write and then trust that, people are going to like it. And it's hard because, sometimes you got to be open-minded to people's notes and stuff. And, but at the same time, you got to stick to your guns if something is wrong.
Yep.
Because you gotta be able to sleep at night. So
yeah.
And I think if you have a problem with people telling you what to write and what not to write, I think then your option is to be kind of a writer director, like Kevin Smith or something. Even though they're not letting Kevin Smith write his own scripts anymore, I guess. But the only people that really, I think the writer directors. Are the closest to indie people in Hollywood. They're the people that get to, like Quentin Tarantino, they get to make their visions more. Whereas a director, where people who are just directors just write, just direct things that aren't their scripts, and writers end up selling their stuff away. And
right.
Yeah. So if the creativity and the art is what's important to you, then I'd say stick with the indie side and try to break in as a writer director. But if you love to write, and if you're good at writing and you can write things that maybe you're not even that interested in, or something that's like a sequel to something completely random, I think that there's room for you too. I think the more writing the better, right?
Yeah. Well, and to be a writer director, really the only way you can do that is you got to just pick up a camera and start doing it.
Yeah.
You can't wait for people to give you permission to do things. So if you want to write, write. But I think anyone out there who wants to write really should try and direct.
Yeah, you can't just go out and write a Murphy Brown.
Right. I mean, I have friends who are doing that, and that's fine. And I'm kind of in between, because I'm sort of like, my sensibilities are kind of indie and then kind of Hollywood at the same time. So I'm trying to bounce back and forth. If you don't want to just become a hack, I think you need to pick up a camera and start making short films. That's the only way you're going to be, get a taste of what it's like to just do things because that's the way you want to do them.
Yeah.
Or you can get other hacks to shoot the movie for you, like I do.
Yeah, that works too.
Sing!
Just kidding, Jay.
That's awesome.
You're a genius, Jay. You're a genius. All right, guys. So let's move on to our next segment. We got a cool show for you, and hopefully Dominic will join us for Schmollywood. But we're gonna go on right now to Think How I Think. We're gonna do little things that are a little out of order here. So we'll see you there. Okay.
All right.
Okay, welcome to Think How I Think. This is the movie review section. Schmollywood's coming later. We're going a little bit out of order, so Dominic could join us. But Dominic didn't see this movie with us anyway, so it's just me, Jay, and Scotty. Hey, guys.
Yep.
Hey.
What's up?
Yeah, so the three of us, we saw Lovely Bones.
Da-da-da!
Or as I like to call it, what happened, Peter Jackson?
Yeah, where'd you go wrong?
I think we're all going to be on the same page with this one.
Yeah, but
this is going to be scathing.
Yeah, so this may be a unique review. Jay, you're a rabid Peter Jackson fan.
Yeah.
King Kong was on your top movies of the decade.
Yeah.
Right? And Scotty, you were saying you're a pretty big fan of the book Lovely Bones.
Right.
Me, I'm okay with Peter Jackson, and I read about half of the book, so let's get into it.
Okay.
All right, so Jay, initial thoughts. Go ahead.
Okay, so watching it started out decent enough, but then as soon as she gets, it's no secret, she gets murdered, right, and she's in heaven, it just goes completely bonkers. Not even bonkers, it just gets really horrible, really bad. It's a mess. And I think one of the things is, and maybe we could talk about it a little while, but like, it was, I don't know, Roger Ebert summed it up pretty well if you read his review about the Lovely Bones. But
hey,
it just
hey,
seems...
you can't just do a review and say read someone else's review.
No. I'm not.
Unless you're talking about Ebert.
Yeah. Well, no. Here's my thing. Where I come in. He was. I think Peter Jackson was a little afraid to go into too dark of places. movie, and so you never really got an emotion or a feeling from what was happening to the characters, or you know how they felt or why they felt this way. I mean, obviously you go, oh yeah, they're all gonna be sad about this, but there was no depth to their feelings and their emotions. The actors, I think, you just skimmed over, you know, like some of the darker parts that I think should have been explored a little more.
Yeah, well, I mean, for a really dark movie, it wasn't that dark. I could agree with you there. It was, and Scotty, correct me if I'm wrong, but this movie is really different from the book, right?
Tonally, yeah. I mean, it cuts a lot out of the book. Yeah. It follows the basic plot pretty closely. But it's like the Cliff Notes version of the book. I mean, it's like the greatest hits of the book, except for it doesn't actually have a lot of the best scenes. But yeah.
Well, what I noticed right away, because I read most of the book. I mean, I kind of put it down because I saw the movie. But one glaring difference is in the book, the character Susie goes to heaven, and it's like an afterlife. Like she's having a life out there. She lives in an apartment with a roommate, and she has people she interacts with, and she has a, you know, she can watch the living, but she also has a life. She also, you know, meets people and things like that. And Peter Jackson kind of took that all away, and he kind of made heaven just kind of her little forest of symbolism.
Yeah, it was just
I honestly have no idea what he thought he was doing with the heaven stuff. I mean, okay, so you've got Weta Workshop. That's great. But, you know, give them a break and just shoot a movie.
I don't even think the heaven stuff was all that impressive anyway.
No, it looked bad.
Well, it was all green screen and CGI, which I've said in previous
bad green screen and CGI.
There was nothing new about it. There was nothing spectacular about it. It was just so, I don't know, it just seemed lazy.
Yeah.
It kind of did.
It was actually kind of infuriating because he had some interview. I don't remember exactly what he said, but he said something like, oh, the in-between stuff, the heaven stuff, that's the key to the movie, and you really have to be careful how you do it because you really got to express what's in the book, but you can't be cheesy. And then I watched the movie and thought, what?
Yeah, like, and the thing about following the book is Peter Jackson's an adapter. He's not a writer-director like we were talking about earlier. I mean, maybe he used to be. But you know, The Lord of the Rings, you know, specifically, I mean, he tries so hard to get Tolkien's vision on screen. I mean, even when he cuts stuff out like a character like Tom Bombadil, he puts Tom Bombadil's lines in later, you know, spoken by another character or something. You know, he really tried to get everything in there. And then it seems like Lovely Bones, he just said, he's just like, oh, well, the book's not important. It's, you know, we're going to retool the story. So it's how I think heaven should look, not how the author did.
Right.
And that's a really typical thing in Hollywood. Usually the books don't follow the movies much at all. I mean, the movies don't follow the books much at all. But in Peter Jackson's case, it seemed like that used to be important to him, and now it's not anymore.
Well, this is what happens, I think, when you become so big that tell you anything.
Yeah, he's too big. Is that it? Is he
in
the camera now?
Because I think if the Peter Jackson who had made Heavenly Creatures had made The Lovely Bones, I think it would have been brilliant. But I think he's just too far into the Hollywood thing. He's too lost in this, look what I can do with the CGI mentality. And he just lost the thread of the movie. I mean, as far as like the story and the performances, it just felt like the last half of this movie was the you know, the last third of the Return of the King, where you have all the hobbits staring lovingly at each other with slow motion camera and stuff. I mean, that's all this movie was, you know.
I felt like they were reading lines and not really emoting anything.
Yeah.
Any of the actors, like Mark Wahlberg, was just reading lines, and Peter Jackson said, okay, be angry and break this ship in a bottle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was the most surface attempt at a performance. I thought the girl was pretty good sort of until the end, and then she kind of lost me. But and Stanley Tucci, who everyone's in love with, I didn't think he was that great either.
Really? I thought Tucci did pretty good. I thought he was probably the best one in it. I mean,
he's the best in it, but, you know, it's kind of a low bar, isn't it?
Well, I mean, he just was so creepy in it, but But his character, I mean, there's certain scenes that were good in this movie. Like, I would say the floorboard scene was extremely suspenseful. Like, you know, I was edge of my seat suspense, but that was, but those scenes are kind of few and far between.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's definitely the best thing in it. The two best scenes in the movie, I think, are the scene where he takes, I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but the scene where he basically takes the girl where, you know, he's going to do his dirty business with her is terrifying. And then the scene with the floorboards later in the movie is also really well done. But that's about it, I think.
Yeah, but here's the, okay, so I agree with you. The scene where he takes her underground is really creepy. But then the whole death, I think that was another thing that Peter Jackson just took weird liberties on and didn't follow the book. I mean, the death of the book is probably the most interesting thing I've read in a long time. The way she describes this girl's last moments is like, it was really horrifying. But and Peter Jackson just had to run out the hole and didn't show anything, and it made me feel weird because I kind of wanted to see the rape scene a little bit. I was like, you know, because it adds to the how horrifying this movie is. And
well, that's what I'm talking about. Like I'm talking about he just skimmed over like when the movie started to get a little too dark and maybe a little too icky or something. He just like breezed over it with a different cut, and then we don't really get any emotion through that experience. And it's just like, you know, and I brought up Precious. I mean, Precious, there's this like whole, you know, she gets raped by her father and we're in that moment and it's going through her mind of how she's trying to think of other ways to get out of that moment, you know, mentally. And I had a more connection with that. Whereas this, it was just kind of like, oh, you know, yeah. Like what you said, she just escapes right away, but then you find out, oh, I guess she didn't.
Well, and here's and the thing about Precious is you're right. In Precious, she gets raped, but it doesn't graphically show the rape scene. It shows what she's thinking, and that's what Lovely Bones could have done because the book was that. It was and the thing that makes the book so interesting, I think, is it's a horrible event told in the perspective of the dead little girl, and so there's a whole innocence to it and a whole like humor to it. Like she says it. She talks about it like it's no big deal type thing.
Right.
You know, she talks about her rape and her murder as if it's just like, oh, well, that's how I died. And it seemed important then. But, you know, now I'm, you know, I mean, and in the movie, it was much more like, my killer is alive. And I don't know. It was a lot more. I mean, I guess I'm not really saying what I'm trying to say. Well, besides that. Except that I think it was there in the book, and Peter Jackson ruined something that could have been good.
They just took out all the moments, you know, all the moments that made you feel just were gone, and it was just washed over. Everything was just kind of washed over.
Say, by not showing the death, like you were saying, I mean, the reason why that works so well in the book is that it kind of comes out of nowhere. And you're just confronted with this horrible, awful scene, which then colors your impression of everything that happens afterwards because you can't get that scene out of your head. And it's not graphic and it's not gratuitous, but it's horrifying. Yeah. And in the movie, it's just kind of like, oh, that didn't seem that bad. She didn't really notice it until later.
Well, in the movie, you don't even know she died until they tell you. It's like, you know,
I thought the lead up to it, I thought his sort of seduction of her getting her down there and then her realization of what was about to happen was really well done. But then it just, it cuts away. And I thought it kind of copped out. I mean, if you're going to go there, you need to go there. You don't need to show, you don't need to make it some brutal, you know, French extremity film or something like Irreversible, but you do need to like let us feel the trauma because otherwise we're not going to care.
And that's how I felt the rest of the movie. I didn't care, you know.
But then the rest of the movie, I mean, like I said, I didn't finish the book, but it seems like it's all building to something. It seems like, I mean, she kind of comes back as a ghost a little bit. She can see her in reflections. She's giving signals to her father. Her anger is fueling his rage. I mean, I get all that, but it all led to nothing. All this movie was about was she wanted to get kissed. It seemed like.
Yeah,
which I actually found really almost offensive.
And that boyfriend was a really small role in the book. He wasn't like in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to put suspense, like the climax of the movie is this whole thing where they're rolling the safe into the sinkhole. The safe has her body parts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a really quick thing in the book. It wasn't and Peter Jackson turns it into the climax, and then it didn't even matter in the end. It was just like, what the, I just didn't get what he was trying to do. I mean, sometimes I can see like Peter Jackson. I mean, I'm sorry, like James Cameron's Avatar. I mean, it's no joke that I thought, I mean, it's no secret that I thought that movie was terrible, but I could see what James Cameron was like going. Like I could see the kind of movie James Cameron, you know, was trying to make. Whereas Peter Jackson, I don't even know what this was. I don't know if it was
no.
I don't know if it was a love story.
I don't know what it is he saw in the book that made him want to make the movie, because he completely sort of ruined it, missed the point. I mean, that's the main thing, is I think he missed the point of the movie. It's not just a bad adaptation of a book. It's an adaptation of a book that completely isn't about what the book is about. You know, and I don't even know what the movie's supposed to be about. I mean, if you were to ask me what's the theme of this movie, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Heaven is better to live in than Earth, I guess. You know, it's like,
well, I guess, yeah.
Well, I mean, you brought up Roger Ebert, Jay, and I made fun of you a little bit, but Roger Ebert, I mean, sometimes he's completely off base with his reviews, I think, and sometimes he's right on. And his review, I'll link to it, of Lovely Bone. Roger Ebert really wrote what I was thinking, and he was insulted as well, Scotty. He thought this movie was about what happens to girls who get raped and murdered is that they get to be tortured in the afterlife and hang out with their fellow victims and run through fields. That's about as far as it went. And that's just so like sad and stupid, you know, I don't,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not what the book was. I didn't even have to finish the book to know that's not what the book was. And
the movie was just sloppy. It was just completely sloppy. Say, maybe they should have read their first draft before shooting that.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, that's what it felt like. Is I think they shot a first draft. I mean, I don't think they did any real work on it. But I was gonna say is that the book is very clearly about grief and about the process of letting go. You know, within this kind of framework of there is a thriller element, but it's certainly not the focus of the movie. Or the focus of the book. And then the movie, it's just kind of, yeah, it's kind of about what Roger Ebert said, which is like, you know, if you get raped and murdered, it's just worse. Yeah. I mean,
there's three of us who have no idea what the theme of this movie is or what it was supposed to be about. And it was a movie, when you watch it, it goes absolutely nowhere. Not really anywhere.
Well, I can tell you what this movie's about. This movie's about Peter Jackson trying to prove that he can still make like artsy films after doing King Kong and all the Lord of the Rings movies.
I think
it's very show-offy, and with the subject matter he's dealing with, that felt really inappropriate.
Yeah, I think you're right, and the show-offy is there. Like the symbolism is laid on thick. I mean, we got broken mm-hmm. bottles, we got crumbling gazebos. I mean, mm-hmm. we have all this. You know, it's all done, like you said, it was lazily done. It was all, he was like, okay, the CGI will take care of this, CGI will take care of that. And there's a part where there's a sunset in heaven, and they're like, it's beautiful. And it's like, it's supposed to be beautiful, it's heaven. And Jay and I made a movie called Heaven, and we had a sunset in our heaven, and our sunset was a real sunset. And I think it looked better than Peter Jackson's imagined sunset, and I don't know.
Well, it didn't look like a video game.
Yeah, it was just so half-assed. I mean, it really was. It was people. I mean, I said it before in other podcasts. People are relying on these green screen technology and this.
Well, and I think these movies are losing their souls because of it. You know, a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like,
I mean,
well, instead of going out there and waiting and shooting a sunset, I could pick any sunset that I want and, you know, match it up. It's like, well, okay, but I don't know. To me, that kind of defeats the purpose of like.
And it doesn't look like a sunset. It looks like CGI. It doesn't look like a sunset. You know, I mean,
I think people, you know, when they're out, you know, actors or whoever, when they're out there shooting on a real location or something, and they see a real sunset, you know, you're gonna get more emotion out of them when, you know, there's a big blue green screen behind them.
Okay,
it's just like, okay, pretend there's, oh, okay.
And am I wrong, or did Peter Jackson and the cast of Lord of the Rings camp out one night just so they could wake up early and get a sunrise in this isolated part of New Zealand, and they did everything they could just to get this shot, and now he does fake sunsets. What is
that? Yeah. I mean, well, here's my feeling about Peter Jackson, because I used to be a big fan, and he sort of lost me a bit with King Kong, even though there's a lot of King Kong that I like. But my problem with it, and I know, Jay, that you like this, but I'm going
to
tear it apart anyway. The whole T-Rexes swinging through the vines thing, to me, in that movie, I just remember watching it thinking, like, you know, just because you can do a scene doesn't mean you should. You know, just because you can come up with it and you have $200 million and your own, you know, in your hip pocket, you know, CGI workshop, sometimes you still need to have your internal editor saying, you know what? Is this necessary for the story? And my problem with King Kong was that, you know, there's a half hour I could cut out of that movie. That's, you know, stuff that looks kind of cool, but just doesn't go anywhere.
That's kind of my problem with it too. It just goes on too long. Yeah. And you're talking about chaos theory, right? Just because you could doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, basically.
That's a Jurassic Park theory.
Yeah. but I think you can apply that to almost the entire Lovely Bones. I mean, you know, particularly almost everything that happens in heaven, it's just like, yeah, you probably shouldn't have done that. You probably should have just kept it simple.
I think it was just bad from the start. They just wrote a bad script. They just adapted it completely wrong. And, you know, it probably could have been a really great movie. I honestly see this as something that could have been a really great movie. And when I heard Peter Jackson, you know, doing this, it's like, oh, okay, it's in good hands, you know. But
yeah, well, I had high hopes because I mean, Heavenly Creatures is one of my favorite movies, and it's Heavenly Creatures is, you know, sort of in the same ballpark of what The Lovely Bones should have done, and that's why I said if the Peter Jackson who had made that movie back in '94 was still around to do The Lovely Bones, I think we would be raving about it. But,
okay,
right,
this,
yeah.
And this is the train spotting theory. This is coming up in almost every episode. So is every director, I mean, it does it get to a point where a director just has too much power and too much money and then they just start to suck? I mean, it seems like it's happening to everybody. Or is this just a fluke of bad movies? Is Sam Raimi and Peter Jackson and James Cameron and George Lucas, are they just at a slump? And Steven Spielberg, are they gonna have a second wind? Or
look
is
back
this...
at all the 70s directors, you know, Scorsese and all those guys, you know, they came out of the box with like Mean Streets and Taxi Driver, and everyone's thought they were great, and all of a sudden you had, you know, Peter Bogdanovich was walking around wearing like ascots and smoking jackets, and Martin Scorsese thought he could, you know, make a musical with Robert De Niro singing, and, you know, kind of destroyed their careers for a while. I mean, I think
Scorsese is a good example of the bounce back I'm talking about. Like, Scorsese has made some stinkers, but he still makes good movies, even though he's old and rich and successful and whatever. I mean, is there any hope for these?
Oh, I have hope for Peter Jackson. I mean, I've loved a lot of what he's done. First one that I've hated, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'd say Peter Jackson might still have it in him. Steven Spielberg, would you say we're ever going to see a good Spielberg movie again?
Well, I'm going to open up a can of worms here, but I actually didn't hate Indy 4 like you guys did. I'm not going to say it's good, but there was stuff in it. Yeah.
There was stuff in it you enjoyed. Can you name
there
two
was
names?
Stuff.
I
actually... Oh, I hated The Fridge. But I actually liked the basic storyline. I don't think it was that well done. I'm into alien stuff. I was kind of okay with it being updated to the 50s.
I was okay with the update. But then, I don't know. It's just so...
I don't know,
it was,
Scotty.
It was poorly done. No, I've seen it twice. And I'll definitely say the second time I saw it, I was really just seeing the flaws. But... You know, I feel like Spielberg is one of those guys where, you know, he's done some stuff recently like Munich, which was like, it was overdone and kind of melodramatic, but there was some good stuff in it. I think if you know, I think he could. He's still got some good movies in him, but I don't think he's ever going to be the Spielberg that we were in love with.
Because I think these days he goes way too far one way or the other. Like what you said with Munich, you know, it gets a little too dramatic or a little too what you were just saying. And then like Indiana Jones, it gets a little too goofy and weird. There's like, you know, his earlier works, they had this happy medium, you know, where like, you know, all practical.
The problem with Indiana Jones was that, you know, it was like, oh, there's some decent ideas there. And then, so why do we have to have this stupid sword fight on the, you know, two moving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. He goes too far.
Right. Days. Exactly.
Well, I agree with everything you guys are saying, except for the decent ideas part, Scotty, but, but here's a new theory for you. And here's where Scorsese comes in. Scorsese won his first Oscar with The Departed, right?
Right.
Yep.
Peter Jackson just won an Oscar. I won an Oscar for Lord of the Rings. And Spielberg. I'm saying, do these directors start to suck after they win their Oscar?
I think that is often a big part of it. I'm a little nervous about Shutter Island just because Scorsese now has an Oscar under his belt. Although the trailer looks pretty good, but
I mean, is that it? Do people like stop questioning the scripts and stop and give them godlike status after the Oscar?
I think it's a mix between, you know, with Peter Jackson and James Cameron both.
And Spielberg,
Spielberg, I would say to a lesser degree, because he still made some decent movies after he won for Schindler's List, but they definitely started going downhill. But I think when it's a combination between you win an Oscar and you make a movie that's one of the biggest movies of all time. I mean, if you make Titanic and it wins a million Oscars and is the most financially successful movie ever, I mean, that is going to affect your ego. Like, these guys are only human, and I think you can only expect that they're going to start to suck. Because who's going to tell them? You know, who's going to go to James Cameron and be like, dude, you might want to maybe hire a writer to Avatar?
I'll tell him.
Yeah. Well, but is he going to listen to you?
He should.
I mean, he could buy and sell you like a million times. You know, he could grind you up into sausage and, you know, make a sandwich out of you.
Well, I could hit him in the head with a baseball bat. So there.
I do think that you know, unfortunately, fame and recognition is not necessarily great for art.
Is being successful at art is a weird thing. You know, and getting ways and getting like so successful like these directors do. I mean, I have a general opinion that politicians, athletes, and Hollywood people make too much money. Like they make a lot more than what they're probably worth. And
oh yeah,
you know, and I think the Hollywood world that we live in now is a really strange thing where you can make so much money, you know, not doing that much actual work, you know, if you're in this weird mega successful bubble that some of these people are in. And yeah, I think that it just gives them power, and power corrupts, and they start to suck. And that's what's happened to Peter Jackson, I guess. And
yeah.
Lovely Bones is just, so just trust us. Lovely Bones is not good. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
I don't think anybody can say it is.
The biggest example of what you're just saying right there, I think, is M. Night Shyamalan, who went from from obscurity to everyone loving him to now he turns out a movie like The Happening and everyone's looking at it going,
well, from what I understand, what? And correct me if I'm wrong, but Shyamalan has his scripts are so secret that the actors don't even know what they're making. Like they only see the scenes that they're in. Nobody knows how the story is getting put together except for Shyamalan, but for him, I think it's half his ego, half his success, and well, I guess a third half, which doesn't make sense, but another part is his weird little twist movies. Like he's so protective of the twist that he can't trust anybody. But in the end, it doesn't get put together well. And I'd say Shyamalan's last few movies are pretty bad, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, The Happening is a movie that just should never have been made, you know.
Right.
Well, like, how that got financing, I will never know. But what I'm hoping is that he got kicked in the balls with that movie, and maybe that'll wake him up. And I hope the same thing happens to Peter Jackson, because There's not a lot of love out there for the Lovely Bones.
And yeah, not it, like it's not like Avatar. Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's one thing. I mean, like I was saying in a previous show, money equals good movie. So yeah, someone could argue that Avatar is a good movie because it made a lot of money, or Indy 4 is a good movie because it made a lot of money. But Lovely Bones didn't make money, and it didn't get well reviewed. I think it's pretty much a failure. And
yeah,
I think, you know, and it got leaked. I didn't pay for it. I downloaded it. So I can see that too. Hey, it's not my fault if you want to push your movie back 100 years and then send out Oscar DVDs. And anyway, when was Love the Boat supposed to come out? Like last year? Like it went?
Yeah. Well, I think we see why it got delayed.
It was really pushed back like a year?
Yeah, I think about a year.
Because I was wondering what was taking so long on it.
Yeah, but whatever. So Lovely Bones, stinker. All right, guys. But
go see it today.
Yeah. I think that's it for Think How I Think. We'll be back with Schmollywood, and we'll give you the latest news and nonsense happening over in the place where Scotty works. Okay, it's Schmollywood time, and we finally have Dominic here. Say hi, Dominic.
Hello.
Yay, how's so Dominic. Yeah, he was working late on set over at In Plain Sight, but he's here with us now. So you guys, it's Schmollywood, so the section of the show we talk about the what's happening in Hollywood land. So a lot of stuff going on this week. There's earthquakes swallowing up half the world, it seems like. US, the Supreme Court, they made it so corporations can just basically spend as much as they want in campaigns now, so it looks like whatever's left of democracy is over. Conan O'Brien has like one night left, you know. There's this tragedy happening all over this world. But do you know what I want to talk about, guys? Let's talk Golden what? Globe results, guys.
Okay.
because that's what's important in this world, right?
This is fun stuff.
Well, you know, right. this is Schmollywood. This is the movie stuff. We can't ignore the Golden Globes. Or can we? And I looked into the Golden Globes this year.
Yeah, you did some research.
Yeah, I watched about 10 minutes. I watched about a half hour of it. I don't think I've ever really watched the Golden Globes because I've never really cared. I've always watched the Oscars. But you guys, have you watched the Golden Globes before?
No.
I think I did once, but never. That was the last time I ever did that.
Okay, so I just thought the Golden Globes was just another award show, something like a prelude to the Oscars. You kind of figure out what's going to win the Oscar by what wins the Golden Globes, right? And so I'm watching it, and everybody goes up there who wins an award, and they go, I want to thank the Hollywood Foreign Press. And that got you thinking. Yeah, well, I was like, what is the Hollywood Foreign Press? And so I look them up, and I'm like, oh, well, they're the people who put on the Golden Globes. But as I look into it, I discover that the Hollywood Foreign Press is a group of reporters who report on Hollywood but don't live in Hollywood. And there's some kind of exclusive club of foreign reporters, which doesn't really make sense. Calling yourselves, you know, being outside of the United States and calling yourselves the Hollywood Foreign Press is kind of like calling us the Moscow Foreign Podcast. Like,
it's, right.
like it doesn't really make much sense. But, yeah. But I have some quotes here. That Ain't It Cool News compiled from American reporters talking about it. So Peter Travers of the Rolling Stone says, quote, never mind that the Golden Globes is considered a joke given the dubious credentials of the 90-odd foreign journalists who picked the winners. Andy Seiler from USA Today says, quote, respect, not much, especially from other journalists who have publicly called the Golden Globe voters, moochers, boneheads, and bottom feeders. I want to read you one more. This is a quote from Sharon Waxman of the Los Angeles Times, and it goes, quote,
the Globes have long been the entertainment industry's dirty little secret. At the heart of the con is the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the tiny cliquish group of foreign entertainment journalists, and I use each of those terms liberally, whose votes determine the winners. The members of this association are not, generally speaking, film experts like the people who judge the National Society of Film Critics Awards, nor are they the members of the creative community like those who give out the Oscars. They're not even represented as prominent foreign publications, like blah, blah, blah. Only a handful are full-time journalists. The rest are freelancers for mostly obscure publications, and some are simply hanging out for the parties and the movie stars. To maintain their status in the organization, they need to write articles for only a year. This is Sharon Waxman of the Los Angeles Times. So my question to you guys is, what's with the Golden Globes? I mean, why do people even show up for this? I mean, can anybody answer this for me? Can anybody tell me why someone goes to the Golden Globes?
I can't.
I can't. Yeah, I don't,
mean, this
I
is
know.
The first time I've no ever idea. Really even learned anything about the Golden Globes, you know? Like, everything that you just said, I had no idea until now.
I have certainly never questioned their legitimacy, and I think the reason why you don't is because, one, all the people nominated show up. I mean, it's like the Oscars. Everybody's there type thing, except they sit at dinner tables. And it counts as something for some reason. Like on movie posters, it'll say winner of 2 Golden Globes on the poster. You know, they'll do a second DVD release for that. And so how did this happen? I mean, I guess it's been going on for a long time. I mean, since the 40s, but it just seems so.
That's why it just got bigger and bigger or something. That's what it seemed like, you know, like.
Yeah,
I think the glitz and glam have just overshadowed the whole entire underlining stuff, I think. And it's just a lot of why people go to premieres and why people have these things is just to show up on a red carpet and, you know, act as like a star for the night.
Publicity.
Yeah, it's very big publicity
kind
of thing.
Maybe it served an actual purpose back when it was created. I don't know. You know, maybe it was like, you know, the foreign press really, you know, wanting to recognize, you know, actors or directors or these American films. But I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, and the Academy Awards, the one that people really take seriously, those awards are determined by other people in the field. Like, if you're a makeup artist, you can vote for other makeup artists. And if you're, you know, if you're a writer, you can vote for the other screenwriters who are nominated. You know, things like that. So that's more of an award among your peers, which I wouldn't say is the most legitimate thing either. But I mean, what is in this? You know, awards are just they're just awards. You know, but this just boggled my mind because I have never heard this. You know, and I love the internet these days because it takes 5 minutes of research to find out that you should not be investing 4 hours of your time watching the Golden Globes. But you know,
well, unless you want to see the stars and the new dress,
yeah,
so and so is wearing. You
know? But I'm not into that. Yeah, go ahead, Seth.
My understanding of the appeal of the Golden Globes, because I've never watched it, but I know some people who watch it, and they all say that what's fun about it is that the stars obviously think it's kind of BS too, so they show up and get drunk, and then you just never know what they're
just
say
a party
up on stage. And like Mickey Rourke, I guess, last year was crazy. And I mean, and so I think there's like sort of a, you know, kind of watching a train wreck element to it. But I don't know anyone who gives a crap
except
who wins a Golden Globe.
Yeah, I would say the MTV Movie Awards are more legitimate than the Golden Globes. Let's just skim over the winners here, just because I don't want to spend too much time on this illegitimate thing that everyone pays attention to. but the winner for best drama is Avatar.
Alex is happy about that.
Yeah, so these foreign reporters, these 90 plus foreign reporters think that Avatar is better than Inglourious Bastards, Precious, Hurt Locker, and Up in the Air.
Well, maybe if those movies were in 3D.
Me?
Of those, which do you think should have won?
Well, I mean, my favorite movie was Inglourious. I would say the best movie of the year might be Precious. I don't know.
As far as best drama, I would say Precious. But
have you seen Precious, Scotty?
I haven't seen Precious. Of the list that's there, of what I've seen, I would go with Inglourious. But
yeah, I mean, so Avatar. Good choice. Best picture for musical or comedy, because they also honor musical or comedies, I guess, are not the same as dramas in their opinion as far as awards. But The Hangover won that, which I think is actually a pretty good choice. Jeff Bridges won for Crazy Heart, which is a New Mexico movie. for Best Actor in a Drama. Robert Downey Jr. won for Best Comedy for Sherlock Holmes.
How come they don't do Best Action Movie?
Yeah, or Best, yeah. Or Best.
Or just one for every genre?
Well, I mean,
yeah. Yeah, that's weird.
Not really.
Well, I think maybe back in the 40s when the Golden Globe started, all there was dramas, comedies, and musicals.
But, yeah.
I don't know. Probably. Anyway, Sandra Bullock, yeah. Meryl Streep. Yeah, I think a good pick is Christopher Waltz, one for Inglourious Basterds, for playing for that amazing role as the crazy German.
Yeah.
He spoke like 30 languages in that movie, I swear. Yeah. He was
brilliant. He's pretty awesome.
Yeah, Monique.
Deserves that for sure.
Yeah, I would hope he wins an Oscar. Monique won the Golden Globe Supporting Actress for Precious, which I think is pretty well deserved.
Yeah.
Director, any guesses?
Oh, God.
Cameron.
Cameron, he's brilliant. Screenplay went to Up in the Air, which I guess a good screenplay. I don't know. I didn't read it. what I don't get about Up in the Air? What is with the firing job? How is that even like a real? Is that that's not a real job, is it, guys? The
going 5 minutes of research on the internet.
Yeah,
I would say so. Yes, I would say it is a very legitimate job that does happen.
I seem to remember that I read a thing about it a few months ago when the movie came out, basically saying yes, this is a real job.
In the movie, they go like, "Oh, have you looked at her numbers? Her numbers are great." It's like, what does that mean? Does that mean like the numbers of people she fired, or like the comment they filled out, or what? How do you get numbers for firing people? Yeah. But besides that, I think that movie's really good. But Crazy Heart, Up, won something, you know.
score.
Doesn't matter.
Anyway, so yeah, the Golden Globes happened. But anyway, Oscar predictions, guys. Who's going to win the big Oscar? Just real quick. I say it's going to.
I don't know. I would say, God, I don't.
I'm
Inglourious, I hope.
Well, you think of Glorious? I'm going to go on a limb and say it's going to go to Precious.
See, I would say it would... I mean, that's why I'm a little, like, I would hope it would go to Inglourious, just because I think it's more... I don't know. It's just a more entertaining movie than Precious. I don't know.
I don't know. I think they the Academy kind of hates Tarantino, so... I mean, I think it probably should go to that. I have a horrible feeling it's going to go to Avatar.
Well, yeah, it doesn't deserve the awards it's getting for sure. I mean, I don't. I think he made some deal with the devil, or he just paid a lot of people off, or everybody's afraid of him. I think everybody's afraid of James Cameron. Really.
Well, I doubt that because, like I said, just because of the sort of legitimacy of the act of the Oscars. I know there's a lot of political stuff that goes into the Oscars, and I think just because James Cameron already won a million Oscars, I think that kind of people don't vote for people who've already won type thing, unless it's, you know, like a lot of times, unless it's Tom Hanks and I don't think other directors could consciously or could, you know, look at themselves in the mirror after voting for Abbott.
Well, unless they're afraid of him. I think they're afraid of him.
Afraid? Like what? He's going to come in like beat them up, or what does that mean? What do you mean?
Yeah, I think that he
could out of a job.
He could buy them and grind them up into a sausage.
Yeah, and then I'll get my baseball bat and hit him over the head. We already went over this. Okay, so let's move on. There's some other news I just want to touch on. A lot of sequels are getting thrown out there. I mean, they're talking about Paranormal Activity 2. They want
to do a Saw treatment to it, like where they just keep.
Or they do a million.
Well, they hired one of the Saw directors to make Paranormal Activity 2.
That sounds horrible.
But this just sounds like Blair Witch 2 to me, guys, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't really just do the same thing again because nobody would want to go for that. So then they're going to try to up the ante and make it bigger, and it's not going to make any sense, and it's not going to work, and it's going to. I think this is going to fizzle out. I don't think this is going to go Saw, personally.
Right.
What do you guys think?
I don't think.
I mean, it just sounds like a terrible idea.
Right.
Yeah, it's done.
There's nothing more to say about it, really.
Yeah, there's not much to say there, but yeah, I'm not too into that idea. It looks like Star Trek 2 is all going on, and it says they're going to bring.
I'm excited for that.
But there is Abrams.
Everybody thinks that Scotty's a Star Trek fan, but he's not.
Is that true?
I did enjoy the movie, but no, I'm not typically a Star Trek fan. But I'll go see the sequel.
Well, Jay and I are, and this movie they say is going to be about the Gorn. Remember the Gorn?
I don't know if that was a joke or not.
Really?
That's got to be a joke.
I don't even know what the Gorn are, people.
Well, he's like a lizard creature that Kirk fights in the original series.
Well, Kirk gets stuck on a planet with a giant walking lizard that looks like it's a bounty hunter from Empire Strikes Back. Yeah. And Kirk basically makes a gun out of like rocks and sticks and things around him, and he kills it.
But, hey, Jay, do you know what show number that is? I'm sure you do.
Okay, but...
Yes, so was it season two?
Okay, so more sequels. Joe Johnston is saying that he's going to make a second Jurassic Park trilogy.
JP4.
Yeah.
Boo.
And I thought they just said after Crichton died, Michael Crichton, the author of the Jurassic Park books, that Jurassic Park kind of died with them. But now it's like Joe Johnston's like, you know, just because he made the subpar third one,
right?
Actually pretty bad. I mean, I liked it when it came out, sort of, but I don't really.
You watched it more than once, and then you realize the error of your way.
I mean, there's some
people parasailing, and then they fall onto the island.
I think what Jurassic Park 3 has going for it is that it actually might have the stupidest ending in motion picture history.
Yes, it's a ridiculous ending.
Remember he like picks up a raptor skull and he goes like, "Communicates, teach me," and he like sings to the raptors, and then he like calls Ellie Sattler, like, and he like gurgles and she calls the army and she sends them to save him. And anyway, what a movie. Anyway, so Joe Johnston. You know, Joe Johnston is saying that he wants to make another trilogy, and this kind of reminds me of McGee's Terminator trilogy that'll probably never happen. You know, but
I don't know. They do have John Sayles writing the script for Jurassic Park, so it could be decent screenplay. He's a good writer.
I don't know. We'll see. If it was any director besides Joe Johnston,
that is true.
Yeah, Joe Johnston. I mean, you can.
It's kind of like a Joe Dante, huh? Just kind of does franchisey stuff.
Well, I'd say
Joe Dante did some awesome stuff, though.
I'd say Joe Dante had something going for him for a while. I think
he kind of got a little sucky too.
Yeah,
definitely did.
Yeah, but Joe Johnston, I don't think he really. I mean, just because you directed the third Jurassic Park movie, I don't think that gives you full reign to make your own Jurassic Park trilogy.
Well, I mean, does that give, what's his name, the guy, the director of 500 Days of Summer, to do a whole Spider-Man trilogy now?
Oh, yeah, that's really sad, because 500 Days of Summer is a really good movie, and I'm sorry that some evil studio picked them up to do something completely horrible and stupid, but I guess we'll see how that goes, too. I mean, you guys, I'm boycotting that movie.
You're gonna watch it, I bet you.
Oh, speaking of my predictions, remember we were saying Tobey Maguire might be the Hobbit, and I said that just if they're even considering him, the Hobbit's gonna be horrible.
Talking about Bilbo, right?
Yeah, Bilbo. Yeah. Well, it turns out they're not considering him at all. Like, I guess I'm wrong. Peter Jackson and Guillermo both commented that they've never even thought about him. They're not going in that direction. So I take back my statement, saying that the Hobbit's probably going to suck, because it might not fail. So anyway, I have hope for the Hobbit.
Well, as long as, Tobey Maguire isn't in it, that's already a big plus.
Well, they pretty much confirmed that he's not. And
I
then,
want Robert Pattinson.
I want Gene Hackman. But Michael Bay is making Transformers 3, Jay. How do you feel about
that?
I read somewhere where he says, we're going to have less robots, and it's going to be more about the humans.
It's made more about the humans. It's
that's something.
Well, I guess. I mean, do I want? I don't know if I want less robots in my Transformers movies. I think I just want like coherent robots that you can, like. I want to see what
racist robots.
Yeah, but not racist robots, and robots that you can like see what's going on, and you can actually see them, you know. And but anyway, Transformers 3. I don't really care anymore. It's the second one was so bad for me that it doesn't really matter what they do with that.
Put that on the boycott list.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be seeing that.
Okay, well, David Arquette says that the team is getting back together for Scream 4.
Yeah.
I'm actually a little bit... I can't say I'm excited, but I'm kind of curious.
Well, the Scream series has one of these. I mean, if you can get the whole cast back together, or at least the ones that are alive, I mean, the whole point of it is they keep going after the same girl. So, I mean, they could go after her 20 years later. Why not? I mean,
right.
But I can't imagine that's going to be any good. But you know.
Nah, but I'll definitely go see it.
Yeah, it's even Scream 3 with its problems, I'd say, is more entertaining than a lot of other movies.
Yeah.
But
it's true.
And here's the big one I want to bring up. Just because I challenged Tim Burton in a previous show to make something original. Tim Burton, and I know he was listening, and he didn't do what I said. And Tim, why? I just want to know, why can't you do an original movie? Because it looks like Tim Burton's gonna update Sleeping Beauty next.
Yeah.
So he's just going down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's going down the Disney line, and
it's going one fairy tale to another, you know.
Yeah, so the twist at this is that he's going to tell Sleeping Beauty from Maleficent's perspective, and the movie's actually going to be called Maleficent, which, you know, I would probably be, like, steaming mad at this Sleeping Beauty news, but actually that kind of sounds a little bit cool, you guys, Maleficent the movie? I mean, I don't know.
I haven't been interested in Tim Burton probably since Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys, you know, Terry Gilliam's kind of the same way, where it's like, I got a lot of cool ideas, learn how to tell a story.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of, I don't know, I just feel like I grew out of Tim Burton. The only movie of his I can unequivocally say I love is Ed Wood. So, yeah. I mean, I might go see it, but I'm not, I guess I don't care that much one way or the other.
Well, I was a Burton fanatic, like, growing up. Like, I'd say he kind of lost me more recently than that. I mean, I was even on his side for Planet of the Apes at the time. I don't know if I am now anymore, but yeah,
it's not as bad as everyone says it is, but it's certainly not good.
Yeah, but I think Big Fish is the one he lost me at. But,
oh, I hated that.
Yeah,
I didn't even see it.
And then from there, it hasn't been that good. Although I do like Sweeney Todd a lot.
I like Sweeney Todd. Yes.
Yeah, Dominic, Sleeping Beauty, Maleficent the movie. What do you think?
I don't care. I really don't. I kind of checked out of Tim Burton probably. Well, yeah, I would say after Sleepy Hollow, when I watched Planet of the Apes, I just was like, what? And then everything afterwards was kind of like, huh? And
but you were Sweeney Todd for Halloween.
I was, but that's just because I can pull off Johnny Depp stuff. And I like some of the parts of Sweeney Todd.
I like, you know, Sweeney Todd. I think that's Burton's best movie in a decade, I'd say.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I agree with that, but I can't say I'm excited about anything he's doing coming up.
Yeah, me either. I'd like to do something original. Listen to me, Tim. Do something original. Edward Scissorhands me up. Okay. let's move on. Let's move on to one trailer reaction for the MacGruber trailer. Now, MacGruber is the Saturday Night Live MacGyver guy, and the trailer just came out for the movie. But I want to bring this up because, Dominic, you worked on this movie, and you were
passionately.
Yeah, you worked on this movie from the beginning to the end. You were the director's assistant, Yorma Taccone, right?
Taccone, yeah.
Yorma Taccone, yeah, the little jizz in my pants dude. He directed this movie, and you worked as his assistant. So what do you think? Do you like the trailer, Dominic? Were you proud of it?
You know, the red trailer, like, got some laughs out of me, but I was really more impressed with the green band trailer that came out today.
Really?
Because it showed a lot more of what Yorma was shooting for than I think the red band does. And I don't know, I've been excited about it since I was watching it being filmed, because everybody's so funny, you know, and the way it's shot is really cool, and I'm really excited to see this movie.
Yeah, Dominic, so, I can kind of agree with you. I saw the red band trailer first, and the red band's the R-rated trailer, and I thought there was a couple of funny parts, but I think the new trailer, I thought that was much funnier. It kind of cracked me up.
Oh, is that what you linked? I didn't watch the new trailer.
Oh well, I linked all of them, but I didn't really tell you guys to watch both of them. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
But what do you think, Jay? What do you were kind of?
Well, I've only seen the red band trailer, I think it looks pretty cool. I think it's going to be decent. I could look at this trailer and go, oh, we're going to be talking about the sequels of this movie on future podcasts.
Scotty, what do you think?
I watched it, and I mean, it didn't. The Red Band trailer really didn't do anything for me. I felt like it sort of lost some of the charm of what the, you know, of the sketch from Saturday Night Live. I wasn't really getting that from the movie. But I'm actually curious to go and watch this Green Band trailer because you guys are saying it's funnier. So maybe it's just wasn't
it's
a great trailer.
It's not that different. I just think there's some more jokes in it that they left out of the Red Band. But
I mean, there's definitely like funny stuff in it, but it just didn't really. You know, I kind of went, oh yeah, I might go to the Dollar Theater and see that, but it didn't really get me excited.
Now I'd say there's kind of a new there's kind of a genre of Saturday Night Live movies. I mean, there's like a whole series that are of movies that are based on SNL skits.
Pat.
And I'd say the first one was probably the Blues Brothers, which is JT's favorite movie. You know,
that's one of my all-time faves. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of it's a great movie, and I think they made some, and I think they've made some good movies and bad. You know, notable ones are Wayne's World.
You didn't like Wayne's World?
No, I'm saying notable ones. I mean, good ones.
Okay.
Yeah, Wayne's World, Night at the Roxbury. Ones that are pretty big successes, and they've made some stinkers too, like Stuart saves his family, and what do you say, Pact?
Pat. Didn't they make a movie?
Pat.
Pat?
It's Pat. Yeah.
The It's Pat's movie. Yeah. So yeah, they kind of had a slump. So Dominic, what do you think? I don't know. I know you can't give much away, but what do you think about as an insider? Is this more of a Blues Brothers or is it more of a ladies' man?
How can I don't know. I would say it's its own thing. I think it definitely will kind of revitalize the SNL things because people already are talking about. I mean, there's since this trailer debuted, I've got to see a lot of the press that people talking about it, and a lot of people are very. They were skeptical because they said SNL comedy, yeah, whatever. We don't want to
30-second sketches, you know.
Yeah, and then they saw the trailer and it's like, wow, that's actually better than I thought. Now I'm curious. I want to see it, you know. And I think it definitely has a different tone than what people are used to. So I'm curious to see how people take it in.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a little bit of there hasn't been a Saturday Night Live movie in a long time. I mean, not since like the Will Ferrell days, you know,
And what I appreciate about it is it's an R. Like they specifically set out to do an R-rated movie.
Oh, is that true?
This could have so easily been a PG-13 without question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like bathroom humor. I mean, you see some bathroom humor in the trailer, obviously, but the fact that they went for an R-rated movie, I could dig it.
Yeah, I mean, I can agree with you there too. I think R-rated comedies are few and far between, and they're usually a little bit funnier. I mean, I mean, you can get really disgusting with the raunchiness stuff, but I kind of think that's funny, sort of, me. I mean,
well, you know, it's like The Hangover, you know? I don't think it went raunchy. It still stayed, you know, at this level of you know, I don't know, classiness.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say Hangover is raunchy. I'm talking more like There's Something About Mary.
Raunchy, exactly.
You know, but I think some other movies can get, like, really disgusting, especially when they involve feces. But, and vomit and stuff, but if you stay away from that, I think some potty humor.
Just throw some F-bombs in there, you know, and stuff like that.
Well, what I've been hearing is since The Hangover was such a huge success, like you're gonna see a big wave of R-rated comedies now.
Yeah.
Because I think the PG-13 comedies kind of got played out, and then The Hangover really captured everyone's imagination. So now, everyone out there, that's what they're looking for. Is R-rated comedies, Judd Apatow style or Hangover style comedies.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so we're going to get about 5 years of those, and then we'll see.
Then they'll go back to PG-13.
Yeah, we'll go back to E-rated. What are you going to say, Dom?
Oh, nothing. I was just agreeing. I think that's definitely where comedies are going. They're very much going in that direction, like Observe and Report, the same kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited about MacGruber, though. I think it's going to be fun, and I enjoyed working on it, and I think everybody's just great, and it's going to be fun.
All right, well, we'll take your word for it for now, but I'm sure we will all review it on Indie Movie Cast when it comes out. But, I think that's enough of Schmollywood, guys, but pretty cool, pretty interesting stuff going on there. So what else going on, you guys, this week? Anything indie going on? Yeah, well, you guys, stay tuned for more info on the proxy. It's in editing now. We have to finish it by the 8th of February to get into the Doorpost Film Project. And if you are thinking of entering the Doorpost Film Project, there's still time. Get that movie made. Edit it together, pay the $50, and send it off to them, because you never know. You might win some money. You might be competing against us, but probably. But I wanted.
It's a sure thing.
Yeah, but I wanted to thank you guys for joining me on the show. Scotty for coming on.
Scotty.
Oh yeah, it was fun.
All right. Well,
good insight. Good insight.
Yeah. So thanks very much. So thanks very much for listening. Please visit indiemoviecast.com. We welcome comments, questions, and suggestions, so log on and contribute. And remember, we don't only talk the talk. To see the movies we've made, log on to ultimatumpictures.com and become a fan on the Ultimatum Pictures Facebook page and the Trifecta Plus Facebook page if you're in Facebook. But until next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Jay.
I'm Dominic.
And I'm Scotty.
And thank you very much. Indie Movie Cast was put into the public domain in 2010 by Ultimatum Pictures. So long.